is the way that the musical mind was. Namely, it cannot be that the musical mind was kaleidoscopic, that it was unorganized. It could not have brought forth those great creations, especially in art, but also in the musical tales themselves, if that would have been the case. As well as an insane person that paints free-floating, and we recognize something artistic values in this person's paintings, as well as this person is not a painter because he does not have his art, as well the musical mind is not the modern symbolistic mind. The modern symbolistic mind is not a disease in any sense of insanity. Metaphysically speaking, it is a mix-up of all possible propositions because no values apply anymore and everything has become absolutely relative, and it is up to everybody to say, I like that more and I like that more, but tomorrow he will like something else. And by this liking, he will go on liking till he dies and will never have love. And will never have had a real relation to a spiritual value, let alone to... So we have no excuse for that kind of a mind by saying we are going back to the musical mind. We are rediscovering and bringing to its old glory again the musical mind. On the contrary, what we are doing is exploiting results of the musical mind, splitting them up, and using them mostly very cynically for our own purposes. And it turns up again and again. Nazism is dead in Germany, we know it. But there's a new young generation of writers who now write, poets as well as prose writers, who had nothing to do with Nazism, hated it. But they come up now with propositions like, we can call the old Greek gods back, the time will come where the crucifixes are in the museums and the altars of the Greek gods and the other great musical gods will be back on the common place, in the streets and in the town, and the crucifixes will be in the museums. That is a new generation who also comes with the same proposition. We are magicians. We can bring back the old glory of myths. We will all live in myths again, empty dreamers that are destroying the human mind with a new kaleidoscopic temptation which can never come true if one knows first what this mythic mind was, what the conditions of similarities we have looked at between our modern behavior and certain patterns of behavior and ideas in musical time lead almost, as we have seen, to conclusions as if we were really able somehow to get back to the musical mind. Yet if we look nearer, we find that here a sell out of mystical and musical values is going on, which devaluates those values entirely. We have seen how they can be used by clever schemes devised by a strictly logical mind in order to gain tyranny over the mind of man. We could say that it is a kind of pseudo-mythical behavior, as well as we find if we look around into the very procedures of, for instance, modern ideologies, we find here at work a kind of pseudo-logical behavior. But both is pseudo. Both is valueless. Both is mere, either clever or mere emotional imitation. The only ones who have really made use up to now of the specific 20th century opportunity to re-evaluate and not devaluate mythical values and re-evaluate them in a sense that they really enrich our life are merely artists like Picasso and poets like Kafka, partly Faulkner. It is also not to be denied, as we have seen, that scientists have in their different disciplines been able to re-evaluate and not devaluate mythical values. I mention only the keen sense of observation, natural observation, that we find, if we go deeper into the stuff, to our astonishment, in almost all mythical stories. The fact that, let's say, old Chinese painters have been able to see that, for an instance, in running, horses have really all four legs off the ground, which we know only since we invented the slow motion camera. They must have seen it. The sense for natural observation is everywhere in the content of myth, in its art, as well as in mythical stories, and in mere ritual. The observation, keen natural observation, that is on the basis of a rain dance which is a magical procedure in order to make it rain, because make oneself join the rain, join oneself in procedure, is based on such a sharp and meticulous observation of the real procedure of rain that it can very well be used in modern times by re-evaluation. Modern medicine, and not only psychology, owes many insights formerly entirely neglected. For instance, the knowledge of the Indians for certain procedures of messaging in certain positions, where what we now very well know and can measure, namely certain radiation waves, are favorable. They didn't know anything about radiation waves, but the observation that certain healing processes go on better under circumstances extremely pre-scientific, almost scientific, natural observation is contained in myth everywhere. We have been forced to think better of many apparently nonsensical indications of myth which have turned out to be true nature observations, which can be re-evaluated and used. We can also say that to a certain degree, that in poetry, not only since the Romantic time, this conscious revival of myths, of the symbolists and so on, but that there have been poets who really, by the reading of Merce, have found in re-evaluation of certain features of Merce very amazing new means of expressing the eternal conflicts of the human heart. But those, perhaps we can add that a few philosophers might have profited, like Friedrich Nietzsche, from a study of Merce, and profited from that study of Merce prepared for them by the modern science of mythology. But this is about all. Every other use we make of myths is a devaluation of the mythical values, as well as every use we make today of the logical mind, mostly is a devaluation of the values that the logical mind created. Nietzsche thought that this nihilism he tried to catch and was not able really to get hold of, the strangest of all guests, that he must be closely related to the process of permanent devaluation of values that he saw was starting at his time and has been going on since incessantly. This is a true observation, but the process which he called devaluation of values has misled us, or just this his term has misled us into a kind of inquiry which finally proved to be entirely fruitless. The term values itself is already a term which is very questionable. Values in the ideal sense is too near to our thinking of values, which really runs in the track of commercial values. Values we understand as values for men. And so, just this big accusation of Nietzsche, devaluation of values, contributed very much to the idea that values per se are nothing than values for men. That means, inherent in that accusation was already the agreement with all the nihilistic thinkers, which is expressed, for instance, in the shabbiest form, in positivistic psychological thinking, by saying, well, those moralities are all just different sets of rules of the game. Rules of the game. What is the game then for? The game is there for gain, and only for gain. So even into Nietzsche, this greatest of all modern critics and most sensitive men, crept into his very terminology, had crept already the new valuation, which thinks values are goods for men, good for consumption, good for the consumer. He is not so far away from Marx as he would have thought if he had known Marx and Marx's economic theory of values.
he shares with him the same prejudice already. So infectious can the situation become. If we want to go nearer to the matter, then we would first have to ask, by using the term value still in this vague sense, is it so that, let's say, as they say very religiously, that the gods have left us, and when we started to disbelieve the gods, and God especially, that by that we threw out all the higher values? Isn't it perhaps first to be asked, how did this come about? If we would believe in gods, we could as well suppose that we might have driven them out of the world, as to suppose that we left them. Let's just, for the argument's sake, for a moment assume this is so. Could it be that some realm has been destroyed, some place of action where the awareness of gods or the communication between men and gods takes place? Did we perhaps destroy the space in which actions like that can take place? In order to look at that, we must first make a few decisive distinctions which we have to keep through this whole course. Namely, the mythical mind is a reasonable mind. Reason is there before logic. The logical mind is also a reasonable mind. Only the modern mind is an unreasonable mind. It is post-logical and is nothing but post-logical. It is post-mythical and it is nothing but post-mythical. If we look at its real procedure, then we find that it is thoroughly unreasonable. How? We find two phenomena in our analysis of modern ideologies that are used in order to enslave the modern masses. We found that this goes, those goes, their clothes is always a mixture of black and white, or black or white, either a philosophy of materialism or of idealism, or both mixed. And that's the structure of the skeleton under the clothes. Seems to be the nihilistic procedure itself. If the logos, as we have him now, in those procedures, and they are all strictly logical as we have found, if this logos is the real motor of all those ideologies, then we can accuse him, and only him, of bringing forth all those definitely anti-human procedures with which we watch in totalitarian ideologies. They seem all extremely logical, and they are all proved as being logical. That is what they claim, and yet we find that they are not only extremely anti-human and cruel, that they also are entirely unreasonable. It is as if the logical mind here, which came about as a definite expression, new expression, new method of procedure of man's reason, has now become un and even anti-reasonable. This so-called positive side, the overdoing of the logos, is accompanied in countries at least where the power is not yet in the hands of the slave driver by a growing wave of irrationalism. When the logos, the old logos, which was the expression of you, the new expression of human reason itself in the beginning, which was either in religious metaphysical thinking, God as the logos, or in philosophic metaphysical thinking, thinking itself, the thinking reasonable procedure. When it became ratio, this logos, that means around 1800 definitely, and rationalism came into full swing, one of the first of those ghosts. Then the logos becoming ratio, what was itself already made into a ghost. It became something very narrow and different, and could not include, as it formerly did, and very well did, all the emotional or drives of the hearts of human beings. It had become a pale ghost, and the opposition against it became a more and more growing longing for irrationality. This irrationality, which goes up into the modern psychological unconsciousness and so on, itself became being the enemy of this pale new logos, the ratio, became itself as unreasonable as its enemy, the logos. So we have two enemy brothers here, which alike are entirely unreasonable and do not proceed by any real reasoning of man anymore. How did it come about? How is it possible that the old logos could be so mistaken and turn out suddenly to be two brothers who are entirely unreasonable? And here we find a very curious phenomenon, namely the phenomenon that the logos itself, this new logos, this ratio, had become the first real new pseudo-mythical force. What was created was a myth of the logos. That means this logos, who once as God Jehovah and as the logos of Heraclitus and Socrates has stood up against the whole mythical mind, claiming religiously as well as philosophically the freedom of man, the freedom of the person, the freedom based on reason, on a higher kind of reason, a critical kind of reason, a reason by which man, being Abraham for instance, could dare to ask God questions, a reason by which man, being philosophical, could insist on his right to his own personal judgment of his own affairs in the world, that this logos became the very opposite of itself, namely the most mechanic of all mechanical principles. If we say today, we are in the danger that the machine has become our God, the machine which we built, then this is only this danger and this our overall in the modern masses. Fascination by gadgets, mechanical things, a fascination that goes so far that no claim of real modern scientists who laugh now at themselves and their colleagues in the 19th century and have moved far away from any idea of a mechanical explanation of the whole universe, that this is of no avail, because the belief of the average citizen of the 20th century remains nevertheless the idol of the machine. Again, we meet myth and the mythical world in a very strange way. We build idols and worship them. And the only progress that seems to have been made is that the old idols of myth, which by the way had artistic values, did not tick our stick and are very noisy. They were silent. The modern idols are noisy and move. And this difference between static and dynamical, mechanical idols seems to be the real progress that mankind has made. Everything else seems to have been the same. Now machines and the ticking of machines go back to an old superstitious belief. Looking at superstitious beliefs is a good means to become aware of the changing inner will of masses and civilizations. So it is very typical that the superstitions, the main superstitions of the West, of Western civilization, have been in that line, the squaring of the circle, which finally was proved as impossible on mathematical grounds and so had to drop out. Second, the philosopher's stone, which is still around, the philosopher's stone which turns everything into gold. Well, the philosopher's stone has been found. We can, though it is very costly, we can change every element now into gold if we want. Of course, only that much gold that it isn't profitable. But by modern nuclear physics, we have reached the point where this is somehow possible. The third superstition, which has become the most dangerous one is the perpetuum mobile.